Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're going global on the show today. Ukraine signs a trade deal with the European Union. We'll look at the growth of Gulf in China and what the art market can tell us about the world economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl, here on a Friday, the 27th of June, and it's great to have you with us. We're going to kick things off, as we do most Fridays, with the weekly wrap, taking stock of the week that was. And joining us now is Catherine Rampell, columnist for The Washington Post. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
And Cardiff Garcia with FT Alphaville. Hi, Cardiff.
Hey, David.
I want to start with you. And, you know, a few weeks back, Credit Suisse was on the hook for sort of helping some Americans evade taxes. Now it seems the focus has shifted to BNP Paribas. Why is it, do you think, that the federal government is focusing so much attention on these European banks?
I'm not so sure that it's that they're, you know, only focusing on European banks. I think if you look at some of the fines that J.P. Morgan has paid lately, some of the fines that Bank of America is likely to have to pay, it's not that the regulators are only focusing on European banks. I think you could make a strong case that the penalties that they're seeking are maybe a little bit disproportionate to the crimes, at least if you compare them to how much as a share of profits the American banks are having to pay. But I don't think it's that the regulators are singling out the Europeans. I think this is more just that the regulators sense a few issues where they can take some scalps, and so they're going for it.
Catherine, speaking of taking scalps, I mean, there are still plenty of people decrying the fact that there have been very few individuals here, if any individuals, who have been sort of held to account for what's happened over these last few years.
That's absolutely true, not just with violating U.S. sanctions in the case of the European banks that you were talking about, but also in the United States when it comes to mortgage fraud and various other things. You know, it's kind of the shareholders in many cases that have been held to account and not so much the actual people who are making the bad guy decisions. I think that has a lot of people very angry, understandably so.
Agreed.
I want to pivot, if I could, to these GDP numbers, that were revised and came out from the Commerce Department earlier this week. And Catherine, I'll start with you. It seems like Wall Street's still processing the fact that the first quarter was worse than a lot of people thought.
Yes, the first quarter was definitely worse than people
with
thought.
The polar vortex and all that, exactly.
Yeah, actually, the Council of Economic Advisers put out a report this week where they noted that this was the biggest single revision in the history of GDP numbers for any single quarter. So certainly things
decades.
Looked certainly things looked a lot worse in the end than they started in the beginning. We didn't think that we had lost quite that much in terms of output early on. That said, there will probably be further revisions. You know, there will be, just to get a little bit in the weeds, there will be some benchmark revisions coming out soon. So it could turn out that the quarter was better, actually, than we thought. It's hard to take a lot of these numbers at face value, even if those of us in the media feel pressured to make news out of them, just because there are so many moving parts that go into GDP, basically. And there are a lot of other data points in the U.S. economy that demonstrate that actually we're doing better than the GDP number at face value suggests.
Cardiff, a big decision came out of the Supreme Court this week. That's the Aereo decision. This is a company that was rebroadcasting signals that were transmitted over the airwaves. This was being closely watched as sort of, you know, what does it mean for cloud computing? What does it mean for the future of television? I'll ask you what it means for Aereo. It seems like it's gonna really hurt that company in the long run.
I mean, this might well be the death knell for Aereo. I don't really know. What I can say is that I'm really of two minds about this decision. On the one hand, it's probably the case that what Aereo was doing was inconsistent with the laws, or at best exploiting a loophole. On the other hand, these are really stupid laws. This is an outmoded, anachronistic way of doing things. This was a legal architecture that was put in place several decades ago. And I think what needs to happen is that Congress needs to get involved, and they need to make it clear that if these broadcast companies are going to be given cheap, in some cases free, access to broadband and to have the ability to transmit free content to people, then they shouldn't also get to determine how they also charge other companies who also want to rebroadcast the same content. It's a really silly way of doing things, and I do hope the Congress will get involved. I do not have high hopes for that, though.
And lastly, World Cup, guys. What do you think is going to happen?
I was not watching yesterday.
Oh,
I'm sad. I had a column to file. I know.
Very
I will
dutiful.
Say that I hope we do well. Because as a short person, I am pro greater popularity for any sport where the best player in the world is 5'6". So in that respect, I am cheering us on, even if I haven't actually devoted enough time to contributing to the popularity of this sport.
And what I like about Catherine's answer also is that it's perfectly emblematic of more general American attitudes towards soccer right now. We're all just excitable enough to get into it while the U.S. is winning, and yet the minute we lose or we get knocked out, we'll just say, oh, well, whatever. It's just soccer anyways.
Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post. Thank you guys very much. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
On Wall Street today, not a whole lot going on, but we'll have details when we do the numbers. So in labor economics, there's this thing called the quit rate. Basically, it's how frequently we voluntarily leave our jobs to do something else. Maybe that's a different job. Maybe it's law school. Maybe it's surfing. Whatever. The quit rate plummeted during the recession, and it's been creeping back up ever since, which is a good thing, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Yeah, we really do want people to quit their jobs, and a lot more often, says Heidi Schierholz at the Economic Policy Institute.
When the economy is strong, people are more likely to be able to quit the job they're in and take another one that has better opportunities for wage growth or advancement. Perhaps it better matches their skills and interests.
The good news is voluntary quitting is slowly rising again, though it hasn't come back to the level we'd typically see in a robust economy with lots of job opportunities. And Dan Finnegan at online recruiting site JobVite thinks that for a long time to come, American workers are going to be hesitant to take the risk of quitting.
The last recession actually frightened the workforce. You're not going to take the chance of moving your whole family for a new job unless you believe it's going to stick.
Still, experts will tell you, to advance your career, you may need to move on, to raise your salary, increase your level of responsibility, improve the quality of your work life.
How many of you are working longer hours than you were working in 2008?
Executive coach Jean Erickson Walker delivers pep talks on this theme all the time. This one is for a group of contract managers meeting at a downtown pub in Portland, Oregon.
So what this really says about your career, if you are not 60% satisfied, get off your duck and get on with it.
Erickson Walker urges these middle-aged managers to always be looking for the next better thing. Mark Kowalski, 51, has followed that advice. He voluntarily left his job at a medical devices company in Southern California for one in Portland with better pay and benefits.
It's a little scary, and I don't think the economy has quite come back to where it was. There is an element of risk, but companies are always looking for good, talented people.
Back at her office, Jean Erickson Walker acknowledges it can be risky to actively hunt for a new job, even in the era of LinkedIn, where everyone's supposed to be networking and self-promoting. Two of her clients were fired when their bosses found out they were looking. Still, she says a lot of people have been stuck in lousy jobs for years now, too fearful to move.
So there's a restlessness that I think that they're identifying in their lives. It's almost, I want to do something new. I want relief. This is not the time yet, but I think it will be in the months to come, when you should feel comfortable leaving to look for something else.
Quitting a good job without something equally good already lined up sounds crazy in this economy. But it's exactly what 53-year-old Jean McDonald did last year when she left her very successful software firm.
I was at a developer conference
where she had an epiphany of sorts as she looked around her.
You know what? I don't see any other women in this room. At that moment, it hit me like, this just does not make sense.
What did make sense? Quit software and launch a free app camp for girls. The first dozen teenagers that McDonald recruited pitched their apps at the end of camp last summer.
This app would be especially for fans of Greek mythology and, as I like to call them, quizaholics.
Running App Camp for Girls is 60 hours a week, unpaid so far, exactly the kind of opportunity that you'd hope people would quit to take a flyer on.
I really had a burning desire, and it may be I'm a masochist, but I was like, wow, I get to try all these new things that I don't know how to do.
And if she can't make this girl camp a paying gig eventually, McDonald says she'll just go back to high tech. Nice work if you can get it, or quit and easily get it back again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's an important time of year for art collectors. Art Basel wrapped up a week ago. That's one of the world's biggest art shows held every year in Switzerland. Now collectors are in London. And Sotheby's, Christie's, the major auction houses are selling impressionist and modern art one day, post-war and contemporary art the next. And the takeaway seems to be big art by big names is going for big money. Kelly Crowe covers the art market for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
So we've got you on the line in London in the middle of what sounds like a very busy trip through Europe. How do the sales in London differ from those in New York? Is the art different? Is the clientele different? What's the distinction between the two sales?
So the art world is a global chessboard now, right? So you have collectors living around the world, buying in art hubs around the world. But each one, whether it's Hong Kong or London or New York, they each have their own quirks and characteristics. There are some pieces that just sell better in China just because they do. And there are others that sell better in New York. And in a way, this is a really good chance to test European tastes, but with this caveat that buyers are, you know, paying attention and clicking and bidding on their phones sort of in any time zone at any moment.
You had this big sale at Christie's and a big sale at Sotheby's, and it sounds like Sotheby's won out. They had the better auction in part because they had so much name brand arts. That's become something that is selling well?
Yeah, I mean, Sotheby's won this week, but largely because they had a really heavily discounted Claude Monet water lilies. A few years ago, Christie's tried. They put a big sticker price on this Monet, and bidders came right up to the edge and did not buy it. And so typically this would mean that a picture was burned and you would hold it for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years maybe before putting it back up to auction. But it's a sign of the market's exuberance that Sotheby's felt like it had the confidence to bring it back a little sooner than expected. And then, lo and behold, it ended up selling for $54 million.
And it seems like at these sales in London and also at the sales in New York a couple of months back, a lot of those calls were coming from Asia, that Asian mm-hmm. bidders are paying top dollar for a lot of this art.
When China wants to spend some serious money, they have it. And they certainly are interested in art more than they were a few years ago.
You know, what can we learn about the economy writ large, the global economy, from what's selling and what's not in the art market?
One of my favorite things about covering the global art market is that it really is a litmus test for people's consumer confidence, right, at the very high end. So by looking and seeing what types of artists are selling well in any particular part of the world, you actually glean a lot of really helpful information about how successful those parts of the world feel. Because when they feel successful, they buy art. This is sort of a tried and true thing we've seen, especially in the last 10 years. But America seems to be feeling well, a lot of American participation in these sales. So they do sync eerily well.
Kelly Crowe covers the art market for the Wall Street Journal. We reached her in London. Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, 0% of China's population plays golf.
Statistically, 0% of 1.4 billion can still be a decent number.
The growing popularity of the forbidden game. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average was barely changed, picking up 5 points to close at 16,851. The NASDAQ gained 0.4%, 18 points, to finish at 4,397. The S&P 500 added 0.1%, 3 points, to close at 1,960. For the week, the Dow gave back 0.6%, the NASDAQ added 0.7%, and the S&P bumped down 0.1%. Nike ran up 1% after an earnings report that beat expectations, and GoPro continued its post-IPO climb. The wearable camera maker picked up another 14%. In Europe, Britain's FT100 was up 0.3%, France's CAC 40 dipped less than 0.1%, and Germany's DAX gained 0.1%. Japan's Nikkei average dropped 1.3%, and the yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 2.53%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. What's happening in the housing market? The National Association of Realtors issues its monthly pending home sales index for May. It's a holiday week for Congress leading up to Independence Day. And the National Organization for Women was established on June 30th, 1966. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. The president of Ukraine signed an economic agreement with the European Union today. Back in November, his predecessor sparked an international crisis when he declined to sign a deal with Europe, opting instead for closer ties to Russia. So 7 months, one toppled presidency, and an invasion later. What will Ukraine get from this deal with Europe? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
Yulia Drozd is a freelance reporter who lives in Kiev. We reached her at a cafe near the main square there after news of the agreement broke.
This is just a sign that the USSR period came to an end in Ukraine, and this is a point of no return, you know? So this is just a joy, a complete joy.
Drozd says many Ukrainians see the deal as confirming their European identity and destiny. The economics, not as much.
Not really many people understand association with the EU from the economic point of view.
But economists say there will be significant changes as European tariffs on Ukrainian goods go down. Anders Osland is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The calculations are that this would increase Ukraine's exports altogether by 50% over 5 years or so, and increase gross domestic product in the same period by 12%.
Osland says the agreement also commits Ukraine to reforming more than 60 state agencies and adopting hundreds of laws aimed at fighting endemic corruption and raising standards. There may be costs to all of this as Ukrainian businesses face competition and reform. Alexander Clement directs Russia research at Eurasia Group. He says this means one of the biggest risks moving forward is people's high expectations.
The benefits of this agreement are over the medium to long term, and people's frustrations with agreements of this kind can come in the immediate to short term.
Ukraine's political challenges, then, are far from over, and there is still the question of what Russia will do. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
As we were talking about earlier, the U.S. men's national team has moved on to the knockout round in the 2014 World Cup. Yesterday, the team played Germany, and I'm sure plenty of you watched the game, even if you were at work. One way to do that is with something called Watch ESPN. Cable customers can stream the sports channel over the internet. ESPN said it had a record 1.7 million streams going during the game concurrently, and that was not without issues. Dan Bobkoff reports on what all this means for the future of TV online.
The first time I tried to watch ESPN online today, I had to tell it what cable company I subscribed to. Then I had to remember my username and password. And like a number of viewers yesterday, I initially got an error message. The whole thing is not exactly seamless.
It's a huge issue.
Daniel Frankel edits Fierce Cable, an online trade publication. This logging into Watch is part of something the industry calls TV Everywhere. It's used by HBO Go, CNN, and others. It's designed to give consumers what we want, the ability to watch live TV on computers, tablets, and smartphones, but also keeps us paying the cable company.
The problem is it's just not fully baked yet. It's such a hugely complex initiative involving so many rights deals and so many technology deals that, you know, it's bound to not work seamlessly for the consumer.
It's a far cry from services like Netflix, Hulu, even the now illegal Aereo that all let you log in once and keep using the service. Michael Greeson is president of the Diffusion Group, which consults for the industry. And he says this is partly why TV everywhere has been slow to catch on. After 5 years, most cable subscribers don't know it exists. And he says the industry has been so afraid of people stealing its content that it's made it too hard to use.
The key to TV everywhere's future is removing authentication altogether.
Sort of like how buying music on iTunes used to come with far more restrictions. As for ESPN, it says it's working with cable companies to simplify things. Its own president has called today's TV everywhere clunky. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
The history of golf dates back centuries to those storied courses in Scotland. The history of golf in China, however, is much shorter. Chairman Mao banned the game, and construction of golf courses today is against the law. Despite that, as many as 400 new courses have cropped up in China within the last few years, and interest in golf is growing, slowly but surely. Dan Washburn writes about this in his book, The Forbidden Game, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hey there, Dan.
Hi.
So let's start with your main character. It's this guy named Joe. He wants to become a professional golfer. He comes home to his village. He sees his friends and his family, and none of them know what golf is. And that seems pretty emblematic of a lot of people in China.
Yeah. And I think Joe really, he embodies the Chinese dream in many ways. He's got one foot in the past, you know, with his parents in the village. And then he's got another foot in the future, and that's represented by this new, modern, more materialistic future. And it's a constant balancing act for him to try to feel comfortable with where he is and to try to keep moving forward but not lose the roots of his past. And golf was his way to move forward. The rest of his family has no idea what golf is, doesn't understand it, doesn't really care. I mean, they all wanted him to be a policeman. Nobody in the family had been a policeman before. And so when he comes back, even if he's ranked in the top 20 in China in golf, to many, he's still the son that never became a policeman because they just can't understand golf. It's not something they can talk to their neighbors about because nobody in the village would understand what they're talking about.
I wonder who plays golf in China today. Is it something that's growing? Are more and more people getting into the game, or is it still something that's played by a pretty rarefied group of people?
It is growing, but I mean, you can still say that statistically 0% of the population plays golf. But the thing about China, statistically 0% of 1.4 billion can still be, you know, a decent
large,
number.
Yeah.
So. It is definitely the rich man's game, and that's what any Chinese person who you talk to will call it. So it's really an aspirational pursuit, and so it's really a difficult thing for the Chinese government to openly embrace because, you know, it's a nation of 700 million peasant farmers who couldn't even dream of playing golf if they happen to know what golf was. And this is why we have this kind of weird situation where since 2004, the construction of new golf courses has been technically illegal. And yet over the past 10 years, the number of golf courses in China has at least quadrupled.
You write that politicians play, but they use pseudonyms.
Yes, that's what I've been told.
It's something that's referred to as the rich man's game here as well, and I know there's been a push or many pushes to get more people interested in the game and playing the game. And I wonder if that exists in China as well. I mean, is it in the interest of the folks making these courses? It seems it would be to get more people to play.
It would be in the interest to have more people playing, but honestly, I think a lot of the developers are happy if people are buying the homes along the fairways, and they're okay if the if the golf courses themselves stay empty for a little while. Now, that's not to say that there aren't really, really busy golf courses in China, especially in the big cities like Beijing, Shanghai, and especially Guangzhou, which is kind of the birthplace of golf in China. You know, it is a popular pursuit, but it will remain a niche activity for the foreseeable future because it is just so exclusive. It's so expensive. There are no public courses in China. And that, I think, is where you would really see a groundswell of interest. But, I mean, I think, you know, China probably has other things to think about rather than creating public golf courses.
Dan Washburn is the author of The Forbidden Game, Golf and the Chinese Dream. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Before we go, this weekend marks the debut of a new show, Marketplace Weekend, and the host is Lizzie O'Leary, who joins me now. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, David. How you doing?
Congratulations, first of all. I'm doing well. Tell me a bit about the show.
We are trying to do two big things here: context and conversation. So we're taking the big news stories of the week and trying to figure out kind of how you fit into them, why they're important, what happens next. And then the other part is a real participatory thing with listeners and folks online. They join our conversations, we pull out some threads and bring them onto the show. So we kind of wrap it all in.
And as an added incentive, I'm going to be on the show.
You're on it. I know.
So tune in, everyone. That's Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Marketplace Weekend, which debuts this weekend on many public radio stations. And, of course, you can find it online. Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you, David.
And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow was flat. The NASDAQ gained 0.4%. And the S&P 500 added 0.1% to close at 1960. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. It's produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm David Gura. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.